listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The month of June saw the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council placed in the hands of the Russian Federation. This was Russia's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Vasily Nebenzia, speaking at the UN Security Council on Thursday, as he recapped some of the highlights of the month, a month that leads up to a widely anticipated summit meeting between the presidents of Russia and the United States. Among the things accomplished during the month, progress in Syria, deep discussions about the use of chemical weapons, and this.
The presidential statement on the situation in Ukraine, adopted by consensus by the Security Council, holds special importance since that was the first statement of the Council on that crisis in 2 years, I think. Now allow me to briefly update you on the main events that occurred in the Council in the month of June. First, I would address the situation in the Middle East and Northern Africa, which was the signature event of our presidency. Conducted this Monday, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Vyrashinin presided over the debate on the comprehensive review of the situation in the Middle East and Northern Africa. We had almost 40 speakers, not only Arab countries, but also neighbors and the countries of the region, including Pakistan, Iran, Israel, Italy, Cyprus, Vatican, and others. It was a frank and useful exchange of views on the root causes of the crisis and conflicts in the region, as well as possible ways out to overcome them. Member States positively assessed that event. I think the main message that went through is an idea on the need to establish the regional peace framework. Of course, it's not an issue of today or even tomorrow, but I think we should be striving for that eventually. Of course, the Council often addressed the situation in Yemen, given developments that you are all aware of, including the humanitarian situation in the country and events which take place around Hodeidah port, including as we speak. We discussed it two times out of it in extraordinary meetings of the Council, in consultations. And of course, it's evident that it's obvious that the Council will continue to follow this, to monitor these events closely. With the Swedish presidency in July, which the Swedish presidency already confirmed. We have discussed the situation in Syria two times, the chemical dossier and the political process, together with the humanitarian situation yesterday. High Representative Izumi Kamitsu, as well as Special Envoy Staffan de Mistura and OCHA Director John Ging, briefed the Council on the latest developments in the areas of responsibility. Besides our signature event, the Council also addressed the situation in the Middle East, including the Palestinian question, like we do on a monthly basis. You remember that our presidency started with two resolutions not adopted in the Security Council that later led to an adoption of a resolution in the General Assembly. Special Coordinator Nikolai Mladenov came to New York to brief us on the situation on the ground. We also discussed the work of ANDOF, whose mandate we are to review sooner rather than later, hopefully. The regime of maritime inspections at the Libyan coast was also extended for 1 year by consensus. And of course, Africa has been extensively discussed this month, including Darfur, Mali, Central Africa, South Sudan. Just this morning, we adopted the resolution renewing the mandate of MINUSMA, and the consultations on the work of UNMISS have just finished, as I saw people coming out of the consultations room. Two very important meetings that I should also mention. We had quarterly debate on the situation in Afghanistan with SRSG Tadamichi Yamamoto, USG Voronkov, and USG's Voronkov and Fedotov briefing us. For the UNOCT, by the way, it's the first appearance at the debate on Afghanistan. And in our view, that reflects the importance of addressing the issue of terrorism in the context of comprehensive Afghan settlement. The other meeting that we had yesterday in the afternoon was focused on the implementation of the Security Council Resolution 2231, and the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. USG De Carla has presented the regular 6-month report of the Secretary General on that matter. And of course, in the light of the US withdrawal from the JCPOA, the discussion was very timely and important. There were some legal aspects of our work in June. The Council discussed the work and has adopted the resolution on international residual mechanism for criminal tribunals, appointing the prosecutor of the RMCT and confirming that the UN Security Council has completed the review of the mechanism. On June 20th, International Criminal Court prosecutor Fatou Ben Souda briefed us on the ICC Sudan's dossier, and on 22nd of June, the Council has elected the judge of the International Court of Justice. Our work is not over yet. This afternoon, we will deliberate on the situation in Central Asia. The head of the UN Regional Center for Preventive Diplomacy in Central Asia, Ms. Natalia German, will brief the Council on the activities conducted by the Center since our last meeting. And tomorrow we will have the informal interactive dialogue related to the activities of the Peace Building Commission, followed by the briefing on mine action. ASG Alexander Zuy will present the report of the Secretary General. And finally, let me recall that on June 8th, the General Assembly has elected 5 new non-permanent members of the Council: Belgium, Dominican Republic, Germany, Indonesia, and South Africa. We warmly welcomed our new colleagues and looking forward to working with them. Now I'm ready for your questions.
Okay, so Uncle President has the first question. Richard Roth has the second.
My name is Sherman Brice-Pease, and on behalf of the UN Correspondents Association, thank you, Mr. President, for coming to speak to us. I'm with South African broadcasting. A few things I want to say before my question. Congrats on making it through the month of June. Congrats on making it to the knockout stages of the World Cup. And as Nelson Mandela once said, it always seems impossible until it is done. There is a World Cup final on July 15th. There is another final of sorts on July 16th in Helsinki, Finland. I know it's not on your agenda, but what can you tell us about this summit, Mr. President? And what sort of outcomes is it that Russia is seeking from that meeting between President Trump and President Putin?
Indeed, on the July 15th, there will be a final of the World Cup in Moscow. May the best team win. But I hope that on July 16th, it won't be the final. It will be just the beginning, a long-awaited one. Indeed, the announcement of, on the meeting of the presidents of Russia and the United States has been published today. The meeting will take place in Helsinki. I'm not aware very, very well about the agenda of the meeting. I think it's still being worked out. But I think that primarily it will be devoted to the state of our bilateral relations, which is to be desired to be much better, if I put it very mildly. But of course, we will not be able to avoid issues on the international agenda, and the suspects are usual. These are Syria, situation in the Middle East in general, the JCPOA, Ukraine, and others. That's all I can say for the moment. I'm glad that the announcement was made, and the long-awaited summit, not only by U.S. and Russia, but I think by the whole world, will take place.
Richard?
Mr. President, thank you. Hi, Richard Roth, CNN. Two quickies. What is Russia's reaction formally to the decision regarding the OPCW and strengthening its mandate to assess who is responsible for chemical weapons attack? Second, still another big story, as Sherwin mentioned, what is your prediction for Sunday's meeting between your country and Spain? Because are you worried your country will lose power since you are no longer president with your football on the table of the council chamber? Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. On the first question, if I put it in a nutshell, the reaction is negative. We were opposing an idea from the very start. We think it's a very bad idea to entrust the technical secretariat, technical in nature, of the OPCW with attributive functions. It is not fit for it. There are no provisions in the conventions for that. And what is much more important is that it deprives the only legitimate body that can establish an attributive mechanism, which is the Security Council. And this is, in that light, in a sense, as a precedent, that's a very bad development. Many of my colleagues, I may tell you, privately in the corridors, were saying and were telling me that they understand that this is a bad decision. But of course, even those who said it to me privately, they voted together with the initiators. It's a bad move. It will not bring us to consensus. It will definitely affect, as we were warning in advance, and it will have a mark on the political discussions on Syria, because both chemical thing and the humanitarian thing are just derivatives of the political settlement. They are not issues. Of course, they are important issues, and we, as you know, we condemn as others the use of such heinous weapons as chemicals anywhere by anybody. But the way our partners chose to go about it leads us in the wrong direction. On the Russia-Spain game, we already are happy that we are out of the group, which we never expected, in fact, before the tournament started. You remember that different options before the two groups ended, and when people were telling me that there were other teams that might have qualified, which would be better for us to play in the eighths of the final, I was saying that if we are worth anything, we should play anybody. So if they deserve it, they should beat Spain. If they don't deserve it, they should go and enjoy watching the World Cup on the TV.
Thank you. Thank you, Ambassador, for the press conference. Valeria Robeco from ANSA Italian News Agency. I have a follow-up on Trump-Putin meeting in Helsinki. If you're aware, what helped to break the impasse over the organization of the meeting, and if the visit of the Secretary General in Moscow played a role? Thank you.
I would like to answer yes to that question, because I was accompanying the Secretary General on his visit to Moscow, and in that sense, I would be also instrumental in breaking the impasse. But I'm afraid I cannot go as far as that. I believe that the meeting that is, of course, long overdue, is finally in the process of the preparation and even announced, which means that it will happen, is in a way, on the one hand, the realization by the American administration that we indeed need to talk on many issues. And this is not just the wish of the two countries, but this is the wish of the world, as I said. It's not needed just for two of us, but for the rest of the world, because when we are in agreement on something, the rest of the world breathes better. Secondly, we know how difficult it is for President Trump himself was to go about that meeting, given the domestic developments in the country, which are not over yet, as we know. President Trump always spoke and continues to speak about his willingness to promote good relations with Russia, which is good for the United States, which is good for Russia, and which is good for the world. And I can only say that we welcome that he finally made that decision. It was preceded by a visit by the National Security Advisor to Moscow, who is one in the American administration that still remembers how to interact intergovernmentally. You know, John Bolton, he used to know Minister Lavrov even in the 90s, and they were meeting quite often at that time. He was here in the United Nations for us for some period of time. So we all have hopes on that summit that it will allow to move things not only bilaterally but internationally forward.
Matthew Lee.
Thanks a lot. Matthew Lee, InterCity Press, on behalf of the Free UN, Coalition for Access, thanks for the month. At the beginning of the month, I asked you about Cyprus, and I wanted to know whether, since the Turkish elections have finished, you think that anything will be moving. And also, UNAMID was supposed to be voted on today. It was still on the schedule. The Sudanese ambassador told me he thinks it's going to be rolled over to mid-July. What's happening on the Darfur mission? Why wasn't it voted on today? And finally, if you're willing to say something about this counterterrorism high-level conference, it seems that Ambassador Haley, even in India, has said that their NGOs are excluded, that they're pulling back funding. Since it's viewed as part of this relationship you referred to, what's your response? Thanks.
On UNAMID, I was not briefed fully. With your permission, I would keep it for the later. I can do it whenever next time we meet. On Cyprus, yes, of course, we were waiting for certain political events to happen, including the presidential elections in Turkey, which hopefully will give an impetus to the political process to move forward. A few things were delayed because of elections not yet being held. I will be contacting my Cypriot and Turkish friends soon. And let's see where we'll go from here. I mean, so far we don't have anything substantive that is different from what we discussed earlier. But now the environment is maybe different, and we hope that things will start moving. And on UNAMID, I'm advised we'll have the adoption tomorrow. tomorrow. Hopefully, on the last day of our presidency, we will adopt that document. On your last question on the counterterrorism conference and the statement that was made by the U.S. mission on it, I must tell you that we are not only disappointed, but in fact we are indignant and outraged by the statement. The decision, the historical decision by the Secretary General to gather at one table the heads of counterterrorism and law enforcement agencies and his appeal to establish new partnership to fight terrorist threat. I'm afraid it was from the very scratch taken in Washington as an encroachment on its alleged leadership in counterterrorism efforts. I would like to point out two false messages that the statement of the U.S. mission holds. The organizer of the event, which is the Office of Counterterrorism, allegedly took an unprecedented decision to deny the representatives of civil society to participate in the meeting. And secondly, as it is a habit, the U.S. mission found in all that the hand of Moscow, as it is a tradition. As if we were exerting pressure on the OCT to make that decision. Both statements are wrong. I'm not even referring to the unprecedented language that we find in the text and the fact that U.S. dared to deny Russia in the achievements that it made in the fight against terrorists, not only to Russia but to Syria and Iran, who are at the forefront of that fight. Well, for us it is not surprising because United States often enjoys to claim others' victories, like it did in Syria. To answer this, I would like to tell you that the summit was being prepared long time in advance, and the fact that it will be structured as it is structured today, the decision was taken in May. So the statement by the U.S. mission is overdue at least a month. It was supposed that the representatives of the counterterrorism agencies, law enforcement agencies, and special services will gather in the UN at the UN headquarters for a professional dialogue on counterterrorism. Can you imagine civil society participating in the professional dialogue of the special services? I wonder whether CIA or FBI or the National Security Agency provides room for the civil society to participate in their work. You understand that many countries took it as very absurd. And the American delegation said that it will reduce the level of its participation at the conference. That's very regrettable. I think that they need to participate jointly in counterterrorism efforts no less than other countries do. We will make a press release on that. We will not let it pass unnoticed. We, of course, noticed that statement and read it very carefully, and we will reply.
Caleb Maupin with Russia Today, with RT. If you look over Nikki Haley's statement, she used the term abuse to describe the fact that civil society was excluded. And if you also look over the conference, one of the themes is countering foreign fighters. Now, we understand the USA has been supporting foreign fighters in countries like Syria. Do you think that this theme of the conference played a role in what appears to be hostility to this conference from the United States?
Who was supporting foreign fighters, you said?
The United States has supported foreign fighters in Syria and other countries. Do you think this plays a factor in what appears to be a hostility to this important anti-terrorism conference?
I will not go into analyzing the factors behind it, But I will simply say that there is a room for the civil society to engage in it, in the conference. The second day is devoted to their participation, and they are free to contribute to counter-terrorism, because we recognize the role of civil society, but we also recognize that that the main burden to fight terrorism is on the state, and especially on its special services fit to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I want to ask you about the situation in Syria. The Russian foreign minister, as well as the defense minister, announced that Russia is still committed to the de-escalation agreement with the U.S. and Jordan. But meanwhile, the military campaign is still escalating, as well as the numbers of the displaced people. What do you want to see on the ground? What are your requirements to freeze this military campaign, noting that this campaign is targeting the groups that participated in Astana conference previously?
In that zone that you mentioned, there are 15,000, according to our estimates, there are 50,000 Daesh and Nusra combatants. 15,000. In addition to the, for example, Free Syrian Army or the Southern Front, which are considered to be moderate opposition. Our military are trying to negotiate with the moderate opposition the same agreements that they managed to achieve in other areas of Syria. And you know that developments took place. Some of them said that they would fight on the side of the Syrian government. And we continue to honor the de-escalation zone in a sense that that this does not on the condition that it does not concern the terrorists who are not exempt from being fought. We understand fully the concerns that the neighboring countries are having in that area, including Israel and Jordan, and we are consulting with them on that issue as well. Besides, the de-escalation zones that were established were not established there for good. They were established for a certain period of time to allow people living there to live in more or less acceptable conditions, without hostilities which might have resulted in, you know, in civilian casualties. But perhaps it's the time when we finish with terrorism in Syria altogether, not only in general, like we managed to do on the territory of Syria, but in the pockets remaining. And this is one of the pockets which holds a lot of remaining Nusra and Daesh fighters. I can assure you that our military, who are often the mediators in these campaigns, are doing the utmost to ensure that the civilian population is protected and not harmed, and that they have, if they are displaced, because it's the hostilities, that they are provided with shelter, and that those combatants that are willing to find ways to agree on the conditions, they will be spared, of course. But the Syrian army is not going to stop fighting terrorists, and they have full legitimate right to do so.
Thank you, Ma Jianguo from Xinhua News Agency. Back to the World Cup, because on the opening day of the World Cup, and your colleague and me, we talk about you have a very great show at the Security Council, and we even talk about that you are making history at World Cup opening day for the Security Council, at least to bring the football into the Security Council. Well, the history continue, and I mean, What will you do with the football during all these presidency? You have the football on the table. What will you do with the table? As the Swedish ambassador is a good player, on the first day I saw it. And will the Swedish will continue to put the table on the ball on the table, or you will take it back to your mission?
We made it fair. We asked our Swedish colleagues whether they want to continue with the football on the president's table. If they would have said no, we would take the ball away. But they said they will uphold the tradition and hold it till the World Cup is over. So the football hopefully will be on the table. And that's why I mentioned the football handover ceremony that I will conduct today.
Great.
Tomorrow
Thank
in the
you.
Security Council.
James Bass.
Ambassador, I want to come back to Helsinki, but from your vantage point here at the UN, if you perhaps could take the temperature for us right now about relations in the Council and in the United Nations between Russia and the US and its allies, so the P3. Some say we're almost in a new Cold War. If you could tell us how you see things now, because you've used your veto this year, Ambassador Haley's used her veto, how you see things now and what the opportunities are of this summit in Helsinki?
I had a chance to say many times over that veto is not a curse. Veto is an instrument and a very important one. If we didn't have a veto, we would have been living in a different world altogether. So don't make that accent on a veto. We understand that there are interests of a country, not only ours, that uses veto from time to time, because this is the last resort that they can come to. We may not share their position, but we understand at least. Now, what are we living through? Is it a new Cold War, or worse or better? It's difficult to say because we are living in a different world. The world of the Cold War was when we lived through the Cold War in the 60s or the 70s, we thought that we are going through difficult times. We didn't even know what awaits us ahead. The world of the Cold War was very predictable, a nice one. Everybody knew their limits. Everybody knew how to talk to a partner or to an enemy even. Now it's much more complicated because the world is becoming multipolar. At the same time, we are losing a lot of multilateralism in this world, despite the fact that it's going from bilateral, bipolar to unipolar, and now to multipolar. So I wouldn't call it a Cold War, because it's a different kind of an adjective that we should use for what is happening now.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Remember when the political left stood up for free speech and equality for all in public life? Remember when the mainstream media called for the same? The tone and tenor of political discourse appears to be at a turning point. If you don't agree with the left, you face insults, harassment, and even violence. Is a new civil war on? Crosstalking political civility, I'm joined by my guest, Rob Taub in New York. He is a political pundit and journalist contributing to the Huffington Post. In West Palm Beach, we have Dr. Gina Loudon. She is a psychology expert and host of America Trends with Dr. Gina. And in Los Angeles, we cross to Ron Placone. He is a comedian, frequent guest on The Jimmy Dore Show and The Young Turks, as well as host of his own streaming show, Get Your News On with Ron. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Gina, let me go to you because I know
know your political stripes pretty well, and reflect upon what I had to say in the introduction. I mean, if you don't agree, you face insults, harassment, and violence. Ask Representative Scalise about what it means to be on the receiving end of violence. It seems to me, and I don't want to over-dramatize things, but over the last few weeks, it seems to me that part of the political spectrum wants to normalize political violence, in terms of speech, at least. Go ahead, Gina, in West Palm Beach.
Yeah, it's discouraging, because I think that my whole political life, my thing has been that sometimes I'm wrong and I hold myself out to the fact that I may be wrong, but I enjoy the civil discourse. Some of my favorite things to do have always been shows like yours, where you can have a conversation in a civil dialogue without ridiculing the other person, without calling them names, without accusing them of some form of bigotry. But the left has taken attack. You called it a civil war. I'm calling it an uncivil war, a massive step away from civility. And then they tend to want to do this blame game and blame the whole thing on the fact that the president is somebody who hits back, just because conservatives traditionally have never hit back. And so I think that it puts conservatives like me in a really discouraging place, in that we've always wanted somebody who would hit back the bully on the playground, right? I think that's a good thing, because bullies in politics, they shut down civil discourse. But in this particular case, I think the left has taken it far too far, Steve Scalise being case one, but there are a lot of other cases.
Sure.
That we're seeing almost every day now in the political environment.
You know, Rob, I used to remember is that, okay, I can understand, you know, the liberals used to be the ones that were tolerant and wanted dialogue and wanted to engage people. And now we have a president who can be quite vulgar at times. I think everybody on the panel and our viewers would agree. Many times he's a bit rough, okay? But why does the left now have to emulate that? I mean, aren't they supposed to be better? They've always presented themselves as being the better part of the political spectrum. It seems to me they want to get in the mud and fight it out that way, which is not really part of the left's tradition, at least my reading of it. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, there's an old expression that you don't get into a peeing match with a skunk. And I think it's been a huge error on the part of Democrats. But I'm going to make it clear, Donald Trump has set the stage for all of this. And if there were 60,000 people in Yankee Stadium and everybody cheered for him except one person, he'd be tweeting about that one person that doesn't like him. But I don't think that the Democrats are doing the right thing, my fellow Democrats, in the attacks that they make against Trump, against his allies, just in general. I think Maxine Waters is the biggest enemy to the Democratic Party. You just look like an idiot saying the things that she says and does, and I find it repugnant. I've been attacked because I'll speak and I'll say, well, as a Democrat, and then I get blasted on Twitter from people saying, you can't say that. You're not a real Democrat. You're a phony. You're a plant. You're a bot. And so it's like, oh, I can't have any kind of dissenting opinion. I have to just have an automatonic-like response, then it'll be okay.
I mean, Rob,
so that's what gets me angry.
With all due respect, what do you expect from identity politics, okay? That's exactly where it goes. You're not fitting the mold, you know? Then you're an enemy. That's what identity politics does. Let me go to Ron. Ron, what does the left hope to achieve by this strategy? I mean, you know, you don't have the leadership speaking out against it. Schumer said something and then he got attacked for it. Again, identity politics comes into play. It's a losing proposition. I don't know what the Democrats hope to achieve by going down this path. Go ahead, Ron.
Well, you know, I don't want to split hairs on optics here, but I think when you in the topic of this conversation, when you say the left, what you're really referring to is the Democratic establishment.
Fine. Good. Good.
In the corporate media.
Good.
And I would argue, just for optics sake, that's not the left. One could argue that something like an MSNBC and the Democratic establishment, that is, in fact, the liberal establishment. But when you say liberal, you should be using it in the Phil Oakes sense. 10%
okay.
To the left in the best of times,
and Ron,
10% to the right,
Ron,
when it affects them
and
personally.
And to be fair, the question...
that's actually what
they
are.
Ron,
there's nothing actually progressive about
them. I agree with that. Okay, but in the questions that I sent out to everyone here, I said establishment
sure.
left. So your clarification. Okay, but what my question is, what does the establishment left want to achieve by taking on this strategy? All it does is increase, you know, it just increases the volume and the temperature of political discourse when we have none, to the point where we don't have any. Okay, go ahead, Ron.
Oh, I agree with you. And I think they really thrive on creating this A and B dichotomy of, hey, we're not Trump and Trump's awful and we're not that. When it comes time to talk to policy, they really don't have any ideas. You know, we live more than ever before. We live in a two-party system. Lewis Black said it best. The Republicans have bad ideas. The Democrats have no ideas. So when you have absolutely no ideas, and when you have this president that's kind of a knee-jerk reactionary, you know, that says, you know, some outrageous things sometimes, what else can you do but then get into the match yourself, engage in the hyper-partisan clickbait culture that we're a part of, and try to run with it and hope that maybe you beat a Republican or two in 2018. The third priority of the Democratic Party is winning. Their first priority, making sure progressive policies don't happen. Their second priority, which those two things kind of go hand in hand, is pleasing their donors. Their third priority, maybe beating a Republican or two. By engaging in just partisan bickering, you're getting all three of those things accomplished. Well, you're getting those top two things accomplished. Maybe that third one, too. Maybe.
That's a recipe for a disaster. Okay. Gina, reflect upon the fact that recently, over the last weeks or so, it's been conservative women, particularly, that have been attacked in public. We don't have to go through all the names because there's so many of them now. I mean, I thought the Democratic Party loved women and respected women. Go ahead, Gina.
Yeah, we had the whole when they go low, we'll go high thing. It looks like when someone goes low, they're going to go lower. The whole war on women thing, they've turned that into a war on any woman who disagrees with their politics. I would really like to get back to a time where we can have a conversation a little bit like we're having right now, frankly, where probably the three of us wouldn't agree on policy matters much at all, but we can definitely agree that civility and conversation are a much more intelligent way to go about establishing policy that works for America than slinging insults. And especially, as you pointed to, Peter, it's the identity politics, I would argue, not the president, the identity politics that have brought the Democrats to where they are in what has amounted to a truly uncivil war that is really among the left. The right, we're getting along pretty well, not perfectly, but pretty well. I remember a few years ago when I thought the Republican Party was imploding. But at this point, I really think that identity politics is imploding the left, that they have got to get some issues to stand on and to work together, frankly, because even if the three of us, four of us, sat down and discussed policy we could agree on, we could find something that all of us are passionate about and we could fight together on that. But rather than that, the American people, and especially the traditional Democrats out there, they're watching this lunacy go on the left and thinking, I don't know, but I know that's not what I want. And they'll lose in the midterms because of it, I feel quite sure, at least at this point, if something doesn't change fast.
You know, Rob, why can't the establishment Democrats rein these people in? Are they afraid or they're worried that their base is drifting to more progressive socialists? We could look at what happened in New York. I mean, what's their lack of reaction? Because it seems like the lack of reaction shows the huge splits within the party. Go ahead, Rob.
It's a completely fragmented party right now. There's no leadership. Who can you say is the leader of the Democratic Party?
No one.
Nancy Pelosi, Bernie Sanders,
Maxine Waters,
Cory Booker, Maxine. So, you know, and here's my proclamation for the Democrats that they have to get. The sky is always blue, water is always wet, and Donald Trump is always going to be Donald Trump. So stop complaining about what he says and what he does, because he's always going to do that. Why don't you throw some policy at us and tell us what you're going to do, Democrats, to get rid of him? Or why should we vote him out? What is your plan? As a Democrat, I can't speak to any policy I've heard other than Donald Trump is a creep and a jerk. Okay, I agree. So what? What are we going to do?
Ron, you're agreeing there. No, that my point is that it's been ever since the campaign, not even the election, is that the more you go after this guy, the mainstream media, the more you push him up. and it's free advertising. What, and so much, you know, I've seen him go out on the road. I mean, all he does is attack these people, and they love it, okay? They're giving him all his material, Ron.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I'm sorry, guys, I missed a little bit. I was having a tech issue on my end. I apologize for that. At first, I thought I was like, wow, was it something I said? I don't know. I thought we were having a good discussion. But everything just kind of went out for me for a second. So if I'm not totally caught up, I apologize. But, yeah, I think, Rob, you bring up a very good point. Really good, they don't have any policy ideas. I don't think that's an accident, though. And that's why, again, I'm very disenfranchised by the two-party system right now, because I don't feel that there's anybody with power in politics, with exception to Bernie Sanders, that represents any of the policies
I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue more discussion on political civility. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Ron in L.A. On Skype here. Right before we went to the break, you wanted to finish up a point. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was just getting at, you know, Rob brings up that he's not seeing any policy ideas from the Democrats. He's absolutely right. I think this is by design. I think that really the United States is ready to go in a more populist direction. If the four of us, you know, the four of us sat down, as Dr. Gina was saying, if the four of us sat down and really talked policy, we wouldn't agree on everything. We seem to kind of be all over the spectrum. We have different points of views on different things. However, there would be some really big pillars that I think we would all have in common. I think we would all want to end the wars and invest that money back home. I think we would all want to see a populace where unemployment is in better shape. We might have some different ideas on how to get there, but it's something that we would all want to see happen. There would be some big, crucial, for instances, where we would be on the same page. Who does that not benefit? That doesn't benefit the establishment.
That's right, Ron. Let me go to Gina here. You know why all four of us can have a civil conversation? Because we don't have to worry about donors. Really, that's the reason why. Okay?
Yeah. You become
more of a fair...
Donors in re-election, that's right.
That's right. You know, Gina, one of the things that really bothers
None
me...
None of us are in the same room,
Peter.
Either.
Okay. One of the things that really bothers me about what's going on here is that my first incarnation professionally, I was an academic historian, and I taught courses at the University of California. And I really, really hate it when people start using the term Nazi and calling someone Hitler, because I know the history of the 20th century in Europe extremely well. And the people on the left throwing those terms around are so abjectly incorrect and without knowledge. They don't know what they're actually saying. It's a very terrible, those are terrible terms, and you have to use them very sparingly. Go ahead, Gina, because this is what gets on my nerves.
Well, and that is discouraging to me, too, for exactly the reasons that Ron cited, when I believe that there are productive things we could do if we would actually work together. And for all the criticism of this president, he has been someone who's willing to work with his political enemies. And he's willing to sit down with Democrats, and he's willing to ask their opinion. And that's one of the things I like best about him. He's even willing to call himself off once he's really decided somebody's a bad person, and to stop and listen. And if we had a little more of that particular element in our society, I think we'd be better. The Democrats have themselves in a real position, and here's why. Their money is coming from the far extreme left, those in Hollywood, and the progressives in general. But their votes come from places like the Rust Belt, the unions, where the jobs are drying up because of illegal immigration and other sorts of policies that the Democrats have passed. So the Democrats can't figure out how to get both the money and the votes. And that's their dilemma. They're going to have to start to develop, if they're going to survive in a two-party system, as Ron referred to, they're going to have to develop some sort of policy that can appeal to a broader base and pull from Republicans. Not that I'm here to advise the Democrats, although that sounds like that's just what I did. But I kind of watched some of these problems happen within the Republican Party not all that long ago. And I honestly, and you may not believe me because I am on the right and I don't deny that, but I've landed here honestly and I'm willing to admit when I'm wrong. I honestly crave a government where we have a strong opponent that comes up with good ideas.
Yeah.
So that makes my side better. I think that polishes all of us when we're all more honest.
That's a very smart observation. I think that's really good. And that makes the political debate, brings it up to a higher level here. Rob, I want to go back to this historical thing because I think it's really important here. I mean, when we have people, you know, it's like the Antifa people that, you know, this really the fringe people, they're saying that, you know, making comparisons to Nazi Germany. Well, I would say that there is a historical analogy, and it's Weimar Germany, where Germany was collapsing in the 1920s for a whole wide variety of issues. But there was, during that time, there was the lack of respect and the breakdown of public discourse. That's one of the reasons why the Nazis was able to come to power. And I think that this is a critical moment, that's a history lesson, is if you continue down this path, yes, you could create a very, very disturbing future, but we are not there yet. And I think people need to step back. And all of us here have a like mind. Policy, and more policy. I'm tired of the emotions. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, first of all, as a Jew, I don't like the word Nazi thrown around so arbitrarily and easily. I think Trump, I'll make it clear, I think he's despicable. I don't like him. He demonizes immigrants, but that's not the same thing as what took place in Nazi Germany. And I agree with you, Peter. We have to look at things historically. It's like what happened in Iran with the Ayatollah Khomeini. And we were so upset about that as Americans. Well, why did that happen? Who did we support? We supported the Shah of Iran. What, you know, Republicans used to complain so much vociferously when Fidel Castro took power, but we had multinational corporations in Cuba paying workers 2 cents a day there. So, of course, there was a revolution. So we have to look at what leads up to things. And things, Donald Trump didn't just pop out of nowhere and invent himself and just get elected by magic. There were things that upset and infuriated people. And he had, voters that came in and elected him. And so we have to look at the why instead of, again, complaining about Donald Trump. Oh, he's this, he's that, he's terrible, he's a jerk. And Tom Landry had a great sign when he was coach of the Dallas Cowboys that said, "What if?" There is no what if. So let's deal with reality and what's happening right now. And again, I'm going back to policy.
You know, Ron, we had Supreme Court Justice Kennedy announces he's stepping down. I'm really worried. And I mean, if we think the political atmosphere is bad now, wait until his successor is announced and before he goes or she goes before Congress. I mean, this is going to be one hell of a storm ahead of us here because it's already started. I mean, the ink wasn't even dry in the document and that war really started flaring out. I'm really worried about how this process is going to work. Go ahead, Ron.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm also worried about a hyper-conservative Supreme Court.
I understand
years to come.
That. I understand that. But what I'm saying, I'm more worried right now is the process, because what it does is it taints the entire process. It taints the court, and now you have people on the left, extreme left, doubting the Constitution itself. Now, there's a lot of things that need to be done, but if we don't have the same playing field and the same laws, then we're even further away from communication. There is going to be a confirmation process. And now the Democrats better get their act together and ask good questions instead of just throwing their arms up in the air. Okay, that's not going to help anyone. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, and we'll see what they do. I mean, when it came to Neil Gorsuch, they certainly just kind of threw their arms up in the air. And I think that one of the things that this does for the Democrats is it really kind of strengthens their argument of blue no matter who. Hey, look what happened. Look at the Supreme Court. For all you people that wanted actually change within the party, for all you people that wanted to run as progressives, for all you people that went to Jill Stein, this is your fault. It's not the fault of Barack Obama, who just kind of let his pick go and didn't do anything about it. It's not the fault of the Democratic establishment, who propped up a flawed candidate and arguably the only candidate Donald Trump was capable of beating. It's not the fault of our political lack of any type of hardball whatsoever and just rolling over to the Republicans, because a lot of the Democrats just go along with the Republicans anyway. It's your fault. The whole Supreme Court thing just kind of strengthens their blue no matter who argument. Meanwhile, you know, we're facing a potential hyper-partisan, hyper-conservative Supreme Court for years and years to come. And I'll respond to something Gina said. I don't think the problem with the Democratic money is necessarily Hollywood. Now, this is coming from somebody who the president of show business still will not take my phone call. So maybe there's a little bit. but I think it's, you know, they're bought and sold by the same people. You know, their donors are the pharmaceutical industries. Their donors are big oil. So, of course, they're not going to come out against fracking because big oil gives them a lot of money. Of course, they're not going to come out. Wall Street. Thank you. Yeah, so it's like when you have two parties that are just kind of bought and sold by the same people. One party is allowed to represent those people unapologetically because, hey, we're on the right. This is what we do. The other party is just a little more subtle about it.
Okay, Gina, you know, I really like De Niro's films. He's a great actor. I think he made a complete fool out of himself by making a spectacle out of himself in one of these award gatherings here. I mean, it's really time for Hollywood to kind of simmer down and, you know, we give you a few, well, actually a lot of bucks to watch your films, but I don't need to hear your political opinions, to be honest, okay? Because I don't see anyone really in Hollywood, except for maybe Clint Eastwood, okay, I'll show my prejudice, but I don't see that they're particularly well-informed, and I don't know why they should try to get involved in the political process. Go ahead.
Yes, for example, when they're saying, you know, destroy ICE, it's only existed for 15 years. That's not true. It was just called a different name before. So when Hollywood comes out on these some of these issues, they sort of they make some mistakes because they don't have the historic knowledge that you're talking about. And that doesn't look good either. But I think that Ron illustrates a really keen point here that should be punctuated. And that is when both parties were both listening to the same tune, right? The Wall Street, the, you know, whoever came up, whoever had the big money because they needed it to be reelected. That right there is what I think that people like me who like civility, who like, you know, I am a conservative bona fide, as best I can tell. Again, I keep an open mind, but I think I am. But that's what I liked about a Donald Trump. And that's why I elected and worked hard to elect a Donald Trump. It wasn't because he was like me. It was because he didn't need or seem to want or even seem to have a lot of regard for those same groups that had always controlled, you know, in particular, Big Pharma, in particular, Wall Street, some of those groups. He didn't have a need for them. He didn't seem to care or give them much regard or even respect. And I wanted somebody who would answer to me. And I think that the average Democrat out there right now, they want the same thing. They want a politician who's not bought and sold, who will answer to them. And they can't find that in the Democrat Party right okay. now. And that's the conflict.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here. I think the political established left needs to calm down. And I would give the same advice to the president of the United States. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in New York, Los Angeles, and West Palm Beach. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.